This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A mother from Normal says she's spending $25,000 a year on childcare.
All expenses go to daycare, mortgage, and the necessities. There's no extras right now.
Marjane Gassemi talks to GLT's Ryan Denham for part one of a series on childcare issues in Bloomington Normal. Plus, Mary Cullen reports on the impact a minimum wage hike would have today as she talks with the business community. And ISU might consider selling alcohol to general audiences at athletic events. Eric Stock has more. GLT's Grow and the Site Geeks round out the show. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Every family with young kids faces the same dilemma, what to do about childcare. Every family's solution may look a little different with one common thread. It's often expensive. Today, we begin a three-part series on childcare issues in Central Illinois, starting with a cost that some families find overwhelming. Marjane Gassemi of Normal is a single mother of four kids, ages 1 through 7. She's cobbled together what she thinks is her most affordable childcare arrangement, an in-home daycare for the younger two, and paying a college student to watch the older kids after they get off school. For that, Gassemi pays a staggering amount.
Annually, it's about $25,000.
That's more than half her income from her job at State Farm. The 31-year-old says she's barely able to put food on the table because of childcare expenses.
All expenses go to daycare, mortgage, and the necessities. There's no extras right now. And that's just how it's going to be for at least the next 5 years.
Gassemi is one of many McLean County parents who struggle to afford childcare. Unless you're fortunate enough to have grandparents nearby, parents often pay over $250 a week per kid at a childcare center. Gassemi pays a bit less for an in-home center, about $165 per week per kid. There is help, but it's limited. Gassemi said her choice of a cheaper in-home daycare means she doesn't qualify for the state's child care assistance program. And she says she's repeatedly failed to win the lottery to get her older kids into Normal Parks and Recreation's affordable after-school program at Grove Elementary School, which is at capacity. Instead, she pays that college student $150 a week to watch her two older kids at home until she gets off work. The Grove after-school program would be around $40 per week if she could get in. Gassemi doesn't have a big support network locally to help her with her kids. She wishes there was more financial assistance available for working parents.
I feel that childcare should be a covered expense for every working family. I just wish that there was things readily available, affordable, and even honestly just paid for, because people have to work and the kids need to be watched and they need to be in a safe environment. And that's the number one thing for me.
Raising kids is hard. That's not new, but as more and more households send both parents into the workforce, the challenge of finding and paying for childcare only grows. And policymakers haven't made it any easier. Just 14% of U.S. workers have access to paid family leave to give parents guilt-free bonding time with their new baby. Illinois still doesn't have universal preschool, and Gassemi's dream of free childcare? Fat chance. For a single-parent household like Gassemi's, the math is crushing. It's not easy even for a dual-parent household. In Illinois, a married couple with two children will spend on average 25% of their income on childcare if they use a full daycare center. That's according to a 2018 study from Child Care Aware of America, a leading nonprofit that advocates for pro-family policies. There are around 10,000 kids under age 5 living in McLean County, and experts say there's no perfect way to track where they all go for childcare. In 2016, there were 33 licensed child care centers with capacity of about 4,000 kids, with room for another 2,100 at some licensed exempt centers and licensed in-home care. And there are stay-at-home parents, unlicensed in-home care, neighbors, grandparents. Unlike K-12 education, it's a patchwork. Child Care Aware says it's broken.
It's hard for parents to navigate. It's hard to understand what's available, what they can afford.
That's Dion Dobbins, Senior Director of Research at Child Care Aware.
It's kind of all over the place, and I'd say that in a perfect world, we would have either one system or a system that incorporated all these different types of options and available opportunities for child care where they talk to each other so that there are similar standards and people can know what it would cost to send their child to child care. Would it be free or would it be subsidized or would it be, you know, a certain amount?
There are resources for parents to help find child care. The Child Care Resource and Referral Network, based in Bloomington, serves McLean and three other adjacent counties. It connects parents with Accelerate, a search tool for child care and early learning programs. And employee assistance programs at both State Farm and Country Financial can help find child care, too. But the prevailing view is that child care is expensive, and the assistance program's subsidy amount is below the market average for the majority of care provided in Illinois. That's according to Dan Harris, Executive Director of the Illinois Network of Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies, or INCRA. That includes 16 of these local referral agencies around the state.
And I can't tell you how many stories I've heard from parents where there's, you know, the two-parent working families where both parents are employed, where one of the parents' wages, nearly all of one of the parents' wages goes to pay for child care for their two kids.
State assistance and other programs like Head Start are typically limited to low-income families. That leaves a gap for middle-income earners with children, according to Miranda Lynn, an early childhood expert at Illinois State University's College of Education.
So it's a dilemma for parents who make enough money, but not so much money that they cannot really, you know, for them, it's always an issue.
Many parents choose an in-home option because it's typically cheaper than a full child care center, such as Little Jewel's Learning Center, Katie's Kids Learning Centers, or Cadence Academy. Katie Stillmartis owns Katie's Kids, which has two Bloomington Normal locations with around 280 kids, most between 6 weeks old and kindergarten. She says there are good reasons why those child care centers are more expensive. She says she takes pride in providing good pay and benefits to her employees. It's her biggest expense.
I say that slightly cautiously only because we have such an underpaid field, so it seems crazy that a majority of our income is actually going to our staff when yet they're paid so little.
Indeed, the median hourly wage for a full-time early childhood teacher in 2017 was about $12 per hour, $26,000 a year. That's according to a 2017 survey from the Illinois Department of Human Services. That survey found the top reason that early childhood teachers leave their jobs is dissatisfaction with pay and benefits. Stillmartis says Katie's Kids also hires more employees to bring its adult-to-child ratio below the state requirement, 1-4 instead of 1-8. She says that leads to a better learning environment.
So that's something that really makes us different, but it also increases our costs.
She says the pressure on parents has changed tremendously in recent years as more households send both parents into the workforce. And cost isn't the only hard part.
It comes with a lot of parental guilt for us, especially as mothers. We have this perceived notion that we are the sole primary caregivers for our children. And so, A, it's really hard to share that responsibility with somebody else. So I feel like the most important thing when families come to look at Katie's Kids is I want them to know that we really thrive on relationships and we really want them to be a partner in their child's development. It's not just, oh, where are we going to choose because my child's going to be here 8 to 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. The reality is that children are often with us more than they are with their parents during the week as far as waking hours. And so really it's picking really a partner.
And finding that partner isn't always easy. A couple of years ago, Brianne and Andy Anderson from Atlanta were bringing their daughter Brooklyn to an in-home daycare. But that fell apart. They were surprised to find out the place wasn't licensed.
So we had to find other daycare. And at that point, we were really lost and didn't know what to do.
Brianne says the Child Care Resource and Referral Network was really helpful, providing a list of new options. Andy says they visited 3 in-home daycares for Brooklyn before they found the right fit.
Just the first two, it's like started out the first one, we were kind of, you know, didn't really, you got to like kind of gel, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then the second one, we're kind of a little bit more, but then the third one, we went to their house and we were there for, 2.5 hours talking. It was like family right off the bat. So we pretty much knew right then that's who we wanted.
They pay $140 a week for that in-home care in Bloomington. They're happy to do it because of the good care Brooklyn receives. But they see challenges on the horizon, too. Soon, they'll have to pay for 4-year-old Brooklyn to go to part-time preschool, too. Then it's kindergarten and finding after-school care.
But then, you know, the time that she gets out of school is quite different than the time we get off work.
Almost 3 hours.
It's causing me a little anxiety thinking about that. Because that's very important to know that your child's taken care of, and now we're going to have to start that whole process off here.
Some new parents find their child care solution within the family. Molly Shara Barbie and her husband Chris Barbie of Hayworth rely on two sets of grandparents who split up the week with their 17-month-old daughter, Evie. They discussed other options, including Molly staying home with Evie and leaving her job as a physical education and health teacher at Normal West High School. They could have made that work budget-wise, but there were other costs.
A part of me would be missing. I really like teaching. I like the creativity that comes with it. I like the bonds with my students. And that would be a big sacrifice, I think, to not be working.
Instead, Molly works full-time. So does Chris at ADM in Decatur. Molly's mother, Marie Beauchet, is retired from Illinois State University. She and her husband, Randy Scherer, hang out with Evie on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays. Chris's parents, Roxanne and Steve, take Thursdays and Fridays. The thinking is, Molly and Chris get to work, everyone gets time with Evie, and no one gets burned out. Here's Grandma Marie.
I didn't really think of it as, oh, I'm saving you money. I was thinking it more of what a benefit it would be for everybody involved, not just Evie, but us as grandparents, them as parents. And so in our case, I feel like it was more of a decision based on the well-being of Evie.
And Marie says she treasures this time with Evie.
Just incredible. It's very hard to put into words, I would say. We're just so close to her, and we've always been so close to Molly, and I feel like it's an extension of that. And it's different. I think when you're raising your own children, you have such the stress of your life going on, you know. And so I feel like it's like another go-round where we're able to, like, really focus in on small little things and, you know, little tiny developmental things. And, of course, we have the time to take her places in the daytime, and it's almost like having a child, but you're coming at it from a different place.
For Molly and Chris, having two sets of grandparents so involved is more than just logistically helpful.
Because there's so many baby books and there's so many articles you can read and differing opinions, but I have six people that really know her. Like, what do you think will work for Evie? That's comforting. Because I get overwhelmed with all the advice you can read about, and it's kind of nice to have people that really know her.
That's Molly Shara Barbie talking about her family's childcare situation. Listen tomorrow on Sound Ideas for part two of GLT's series on childcare issues in Central Illinois. We'll look at gaps in the childcare scene and what programs exist or should exist to fill them. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Illinois' new governor, J.B. Pritzker, made raising the minimum wage one of his first priorities in office. With wide Democratic support and bills already hitting the floor of the State House, it's not a stretch to say the governor could have a minimum wage increase bill on his desk in the coming months. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Charlie Moore and John Walsh of the McLean County Chamber of Commerce about what a minimum wage increase would mean for their member businesses.
Minimum wage increase advocates say $15 per month is the minimum for a living wage. That value is also expressed under current bill proposals for the wage hike. That's nearly double the current minimum wage of $8.25. Now, of course, some employers pay above the minimum wage, but overall, many employers are voicing concerns about the impact of an increase on their bottom line. How would that much of a pay increase actually impact employers?
Yeah, so John, I'll take this one first. So first and foremost, the thing that we always talk about with our membership is that we don't outright oppose a minimum wage increase. Actually, we really look forward to conversations surrounding a common sense minimum wage increase. And that's one thing that we've worked with our membership on is exactly what you mentioned is if it were to jump to a straight 15, for example, we have a lot of our membership that would be problematic for. And that's one thing. Last session, we did a lot of testimony requests on a couple bills, HB 198 and Senate Bill 81, which are similar to what we think the legislation is going to look like this session, you know, with this sort of the step increases over a period of time. But exactly what that's going to look like, we still don't know, and so that's difficult to weigh in completely at this point.
Now, you said obviously it'll be problematic for most employers. Could you get into any specifics on what exactly the impact would be?
Last session, we did some survey requests and testimonial requests from our membership on increasing the minimum wage gradually to $15 per hour. Over 80% of those who responded that it would negatively affect their business, and some of the outcomes that they perceived likely would be cutting back hours or perhaps employees, not replacing employees who leave, slowing down the process of new employees. And we even had some say that it could potentially be detrimental enough to close business.
Now, Bloomington Normal, we have a wide array of businesses, both large corporations and small family-owned businesses. So can we talk about how the impact changes based on the size of the business at hand?
So I think that's, you know, it's yet to be known. I mean, you've got between large corporate and small business, there's a number of them who are already paying, you know, more than the minimum wage and maybe even more than the $15 an hour at this point for some of their employees. But there are a number of other employers, you know, in the community who are also paying right at minimum wage, just over as well, based on the industry sector in which they represent. So I think that it's as the point that you alluded to, it's kind of a bit all over as to what that might look like. But there are certainly small employers who are certainly of great significance who are paying, you know, well above that $15 an hour minimum that they're talking about now. But I think you've got some larger businesses who are paying well under that as well. So without having, you know, exact information and, you know, available to us just now, you really can't comment too closely on that, knowing that it will be impactful regardless of the size of the business, small or large. And I think that the point that John just made a moment ago, too, is that, you know, regardless of the size of business, everyone's operating on a budget, right? And so what's within that budget would certainly affect the number of hours that an employee may be assigned to work. You know, if they have employees who leave that need to be replaced, they may not. And I think that, you know, right now we certainly want any employee, you know, that's one of the things that Chamber's major focus is workforce and finding jobs for people, making sure that we're finding skills gaps and closing those gaps and having our students or our employees ready to go to work. But right now, large business, small business, it's going to affect all of them.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Charlie Moore and John Walsh of the McLean County Chamber of Commerce. The Illinois Retail Merchants Association voiced concerns in Springfield last week over the possible hike. Instead of an increase across the board, the association recommends a tiered approach in which minimum wage would be based on the economic need of that region. That's similar to what's used in New York State and Oregon. It's not really easy to compare Chicago to downstate or central Illinois. So based on the idea of a tiered approach, what does McLean County's economic need say about the need for a minimum wage increase?
You know, that's one of the conversations that really seems to be taking hold this go-round is the thought of perhaps a regional wage. I think in our conversations, it seems like it might be a little bit more unrealistic just because, you know, how are those lines determined? Is it per county? Is it, you know, is it where how are those divisions drawn? That one seems a little less realistic to us. But, you know, as some of the statewide organizations are saying, there's no question that the cost of living in central Illinois, southern Illinois, is not necessarily the same that it is in the Chicago region. So, you know, what that might look like is hard to tell. There is, you know, MIT provides living wage studies every year, and would it be based off of that? You know, those are questions that we still don't have answers to as well.
Right, right. Now, keeping that tiered approach in mind, does it appear that there is an increase needed in McLean County specifically?
I think we leave that to the answer of the employers and what, you know, they're looking for the work to be performed at their certain business. The challenge is going to be when you look at Illinois, it's, again, putting us as an island with all the states that surround us, as you commented at the beginning of the conversation, doubling what the minimum wage looks like. I mean, when you look at Iowa and Missouri and Kentucky and Indiana, you know, they're all around between $7.25 and Missouri is the highest at $8.60. You know, going to $15 from an employer standpoint is going to be, you know, detrimental to the fact of what they can't accomplish. And so I don't know if there's anything you want to add on to that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think our preference would always be that markets determine the wages.
Absolutely.
No, and I think in a perfect world, that's the way it would work for us.
Now, pro-increase legislators argue that a tiered approach to raising the minimum wage would create a greater divide in economic wealth amongst the state. Are there any thoughts on that?
You know, similar to what we mentioned before, it's really tough because exactly what you're saying, you know, where do you decide where those lines are drawn? And when you're, you know, if you're in the Chicago area or the suburbs, what determines, you know, one county, one suburb, one area from another? And what, you know, what differences, you know, Peoria, McLean County, Champaign? It just, those lines seem to be like they could get fuzzy pretty quick.
So the state has increased the minimum wage since 2010, I believe. Considering inflation and economic changes, it's really no surprise that residents are calling for an increase. So as mentioned before, most are pushing for $15 an hour. Charlie, you kind of hinted at this a little bit earlier, but if it's not a $15 increase, what would be a fair amount increase based on what we're seeing in other states?
So it's a question that I don't know we have an answer to other than to what John said earlier was, you know, into what you alluded to, is to let the market determine, you know, what it's going to pay.
I agree. You know, you mentioned that it's been since 2010. I think one interesting thing to note, though, is as we've been kind of continuing to hit on, is that every single state that touches Illinois, besides Missouri, is at that same. They're actually lower than Illinois. They've remained at that 725 benchmark where Illinois has raised. And so for us, you know, and a lot of our membership, that from what we're hearing is just another sign that Illinois is not necessarily great for business. That doesn't necessarily take the priorities of and the needs of the businesses and the job creators into account. And really, without those businesses and job creators, you won't have anyone to pay, right? You need, if we continue to add burdens onto those who are signing the checks, there will be less to sign, theoretically.
Now, John, earlier on in this conversation, you mentioned the chamber doesn't outright oppose a minimum wage increase. So maybe to wrap up this conversation, can we talk about some potential benefits?
Yeah. You know, as a chamber of commerce, we want our membership to thrive. And in order to do that, they need to be able to attract the best quality employees that they can. I think a big piece of that is obviously salary, benefits, wages to be able to pay, that kind of stuff. So, you know, and the conversations that we'll be having with the legislators who represent our membership are, you know, how can we mitigate some of the negative effects of this increase if it were to be, you know, straight to 15 or quickly to 15? And I think some of the conversations that we've had is perhaps, you know, maybe something like a small business tax credit. So workers can still get paid, but it's not as much of a hit on, you know, our smallest businesses, which, again, theoretically have the potential to take as much of a hit. You know, can we look at some sort of seasonal wage? Can we look at some sort of training wage as well, just to ensure that we are not putting too much of a burden on the backs of the businesses and the job creators here in McLean County?
That was GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with McLean County Chamber of Commerce CEO Charlie Moore and Government and Public Affairs Manager John Walsh. Listen to Sound Ideas tomorrow to hear from Illinois People's Action Executive Director Don Carlson, who says the benefits of a minimum wage increase outweigh the concerns. This is Sound Ideas.
I'm Sarah McManus. I'm co-owner of The Garlic Press and The Garlic Press Popcorn and Sweet Shop.
And a GLT underwriter for more than three decades.
Supporting for me is a dual mission, supporting the local news and getting it out, as well as getting my own name out there. I think that it's an intelligent group of listeners, and those are a lot of the types of people that shop at our store. They like to support my business because they support GLT personally.
Learn more about partnering with GLT at wglt.org/corporate-support.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time. Accepting applications February 1st through 28th for programs focused on arts and culture, education, environment, wellness, youth, and more. Details at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and wglt.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Illinois State University Athletics Director Larry Lyons says the new lower bowl seating that crews will install at Red Bird Arena this summer will improve the fan experience. Lyons tells GLT's Eric Stock he has other long-term facility plans for Red Bird Athletics with the primary goal to break through an increasingly competitive landscape.
The building's 30 years old, though most people don't realize that. It has aged very well.
Yeah, it doesn't look it.
Not at all. But specific to the seat project, the seat manufacturer is, I call it planned obsolescence. They're not manufacturing those particular seat parts anymore. So we knew this was coming, and it's time to essentially do a complete refresh of the lower bowl. We'll take literally everything out of the lower bowl, the seat platforms, the seats themselves, and then bring it back to code, because we're dealing with different ADA codes right now, and those sorts of things. So it'll modernize the building, bring it to code, so we'll be in compliant with the right number of ADA seats. The seats will themselves be more comfortable. Right now, those are just two pieces of plastic that are sitting on frames. They're not really individual chairs because they need to fold down so that we can move them in and out. But we'll have upholstery on the seats. The seats themselves, currently most people don't realize it, but they go between 18 inches wide to 22 inches wide in the building right now. We're going to try and standardize that to...
Are they too tight?
This is the way I say it. The seats that were designed for Americans 30 years ago probably wouldn't fit some of the Americans right now, so some of our population. So we're going to try and take the average width of the seat up a little bit to make them more comfortable. And then around the top of the concourse where the ADA seats will be, we don't need to use every section for ADA seats, so it's going to allow us to have 8 or 10 what we're going to call Lowe's sections. And that will allow 8 seats or so in each load section, which will be a premium seat. It's not a suite, but it's a mini suite where you have a little bit more room, individual chairs, and we'll probably have service to those areas as part of the premium seat, so we can have a little higher price on that one, but it'll have, again, come with a little higher level of service.
Are those private, semi-private
yes,
areas?
Yes, I would call them semi-private. And then one of the positives about that is as you build those, say for commencement, we always are setting up extra handicap sections for commencement for grandma and grandpa and those that have some mobility issues. That gives us way more to service a commencement crowd. Or say there's an event in there that has, for some reason, a higher level of need for some mobility impaired folks. We can accommodate those a little bit better too. So that it'll be a brighter, newer look in the lower bowl. Be more comfortable. There's no question about that. So we're looking forward to upgrading the building. That'll give us another 30 years or so, we hope, of seats in that building.
It'll be venerable Red Bird Arena by that time.
Yeah, it will be.
So this work will be done over the summer, right?
Correct.
And be ready by the fall?
It's going to start the Monday after commencement, and then the goal is to have it ready for that first volleyball tournament in the following fall.
And what will this do to capacity? Will it lower it?
It's going to lower the capacity. There's no question about that. We don't have the seat manifest back from the seat vendor. They're still working the kinks out because, as I said, as you put different, we're trying to make the seats wider. That changes the number of seats you can get in a row. You try and maximize that, but you want to always try and make your rows even numbered rows if possible, because you typically sell seats in twos. So they've got to go through that calculation, and they just haven't provided us what that number is going to be yet.
As we talk with Illinois State Athletics Director Larry Lyons about the improvements being made at Red Bird Arena as an attempt to improve the fan experience, I know attendance has been a concern for a lot of programs all across the country. It's been declining for major revenue sports like basketball and football, baseball to a lesser extent. I know that you've seen some of that at Illinois State the last couple of years, despite programs that have been relatively successful. Are you concerned about where the attendance is now?
Well, I think everybody's looking at attendance and how can you get more folks to come and view it live. I mean, we've done some of it to ourselves because there's just a plethora of events on television now. And you produce things for television for reasons. There's always positive reasons there, but it does impact. I think you see it across the board. Everybody's struggling a little bit with that, whether it's your public attendance or your student attendance. It depends on the game times, and those are varied. Depends on the day of the week, depending on what else is going on. This is a unique community in that this community is very heavily scheduled in terms of events in the community, be it church events or youth events or high school events or our events. There doesn't seem like there's enough nights of the week for us all to get in there. And that's a good problem to have in a community, because what makes this place such a wonderful place to live. But it does have some challenges. I mean, the biggest thing you can do to attract attendance is win at a high level on a regular basis. But that's also a challenge, too, because you're constantly turning over your roster. So if you can make the building a little bit more comfortable, make the building a little bit more accessible, hopefully your teams are competitive so that people want to come out and watch them, and then try and find ways to attract students when they're on campus, because we do have break periods we have to deal with. Entice them to come to games. And student attendance is a challenge across the country. It's a different thing right now than it used to be 10 years ago, 20 years ago, those kinds of things.
Well, and to the extent that you're competing with television for everything that's on, mm-hmm. you're also trying to get on television more. Mm-hmm. And there are dozens, at the very least, college basketball games that you can find being broadcast or posted online somewhere. And of course, the Missouri Valley has been a leader in that in recent years with the package with ESPN. You can get video coverage of every sporting event that Illinois State hosts. How has that gone for Illinois State specifically, and your sense for how that's going for the league in the few years since that's been put into play?
I think it's been a tremendous success at Illinois State and then across the Valley. When we were having discussions about doing this, it was a pretty quick yes, even though there was an investment on each campus. But it's been a tremendous thing. It's affected what we do in a very positive manner. Obviously, there's more exposure across the country, because not only is it linear television, but a lot of the stuff we do for ESPN, it's on ESPN3 or now ESPN+. That goes out digitally. But we found a way to send that signal up to NBC Sports Chicago and make it a linear broadcast, which gives you a nice one-two punch there. It affects recruiting. Recruiting is much more national than it used to be. So your brand is out there across the country. It's been a really tremendous win academically. We have one full-time person who produces or is involved in production of all those games, though we do have more people down there because of scoreboard production and internet production for different things. But when we have a game on, there's really one full-time person. Everything else is done by students.
What are the ongoing costs to the university to run it? Is it mostly just staffing at this point?
Now it's just staffing. I mean, every now and then we're going to have to change a camera, or there might be a piece of equipment in the studio itself. The initial cost, I'm going to say off the top of my head now, we did this 3 or 4 years ago, was maybe the investment was about $400,000. We bought high-end equipment, so it's going to last for a pretty long time. Cameras are better than they used to be, so once you're shooting in HD, you're shooting in HD. You'll eventually have one that wears out. But so the ongoing cost really is your labor costs, and you know what? That's as many games as we're producing. I don't see that really as an issue. It's not anything that's prohibited for us.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, Eric Stonck with Larry Lyons, Director of Athletics at Illinois State University. If we can veer back into the facilities discussion, mm-hmm. Horton Field House is getting a new floor, an indoor track, and a new roof, it sounds like, mm-hmm. For a facility that I know you have a long-term vision for eventually replacing. First, let's get to the specifics of the upgrades that you're working on now.
Well, right now, the two big projects that are out there, the first one's going to take place this April in May. We're going to replace cover the existing surface of the indoor of Horton Field House. That surface is 20-some years old. It's in need of replacement. We're just in the process of now of finalizing what I would call the design. Where are the lines going to go? I mean, how's that gonna work? Because that is also not just a track; it's also a academic facility. It's also a recreation facility. So you need to make sure you cover the needs of those programs. So that'll take place yet this spring. The roof project will start in August. Hopefully, we'll have that done fairly quickly before the football season really kicks off. And that roof is the last time it was replaced is in 1993, so it's time for that roof to be replaced.
And what is the cost of that at this point?
The cost is projected at $1.2 million. I think we'll come in under that. We put a contingency in there just in case or there's things that you may not expect to come up. I think we'll come in under the 1.2, which will be a positive thing. Horton is such a I call it a great old barn. I mean, it was built in 1963 or opened in 1963. And again, it serves the campus in so many different ways. It serves the community in so many different ways. Horton Fieldhouse is not going anywhere. Again, it's a very useful, highly used building. It's part of the west side of our football stadium because of that shared concourse, and the stands are actually embedded in the structure. The west stands are embedded in the west structure of the fieldhouse. So it's not going anywhere. We need to freshen up the inside of the field house itself besides just the flooring surface. We're having those discussions right now. The glass walls on the south end and the north end, it needs to be painted. It needs to have some better branding. It needs to be freshened up, that we're going to have those discussions. But there's other parts of the building that we've touched. The south gym has had its freshening. It's been cleaned. It's been repainted. The pool in the last 18 months has been cleaned. It's been painted, new bleachers, new liner in the pool. You're buying more time in those facilities as you do this regular maintenance. And then locker rooms will be the thing that needs to come next. And we're starting to have those dominoes tick off. We've renovated a space for soccer, and now we need to start touching the other locker rooms, softball, baseball, the men's and women's track, gymnastics, the other sports that are housed in that facility, and those plans will take place. We'll try and, as funding becomes available, we'll try and knock those off as we need to. But, that building is 50-some years old, and you're seeing some time to start touching some of these things.
But do you envision getting a new indoor practice facility of
some
kind?
Well, yes, because of the extended use of that facility, again, academic schedules most mornings of the week. Athletics has a period in the afternoons for practices and their use, and then recreation comes in the evenings, and then there's the different community events and campus events that are in there. And obviously this is the time of year. You start in late November and you go through probably March where you need indoor facilities more than you need outdoor facilities. So there is a distinct need for an indoor facility that really is multi-purpose and has the right surface for all teams to use it. A track surface is really good for track, and you can do some academics on it, and you can run some recreation on it. But it's not the right surface really to have a soccer or baseball or softball or football type practice. You need a turf type surface on there. We're trying to find the revenue streams to invest in an indoor that could handle those kinds of things. And then I would think it would become a campus and a community asset at the same time, much like the Stadium Club has become a great asset on this campus and this community. It's used way more by other people than it really is by us because it was designed to be a multifunctional space.
And so this facility would be separate from Horton then?
Yes. Yeah, not attached.
Do you have a site for it?
Yeah, I think the best place to put it would be the existing grass practice football field that's just north of Horton. It would be between the parking lot north of the Kauffman Football Building and next to Rop, the Rop Building and the outdoor track.
How long-term a vision is this?
Well, the vision is for me is short-term, but long-term is finding the funding streams to help pay for it. But that would be a building that would be just as important to our athletic teams and other users as a Horton Fieldhouse or a Hancock Stadium or a Redbird Arena. It'd be one of those buildings that could really open up opportunities. And then it certainly helps on the practice side for our teams that just don't have enough practice time because the field house is just overscheduled, essentially. So we're in the process of trying to find those revenue streams that would help us in the right building system that we can afford to build to get that done. So it's a focus, and it's going to take some time, unfortunately.
How much do you think you'll need to at least get started?
And
might there be a public campaign at some point?
Well, there is a we're in a campaign right now. The big thing about this particular project is it's going to have to be funded primarily by private dollars. There are priorities on this campus, and right now an indoor is not the highest priority from a campus perspective, though it might be from an athletic perspective. But the campus has other priorities. You know, we need to get the fine arts off the ground and running. Obviously, Bone Student Center is going right now. Those are just a couple of examples. And you know, the focus needs to be on those. I mean, we kind of had a turn when the stadium was done and how we figured out how to manage the finances for that one. So we're going to have to do this privately. And I don't know if we've ever had a building built on this campus that's ever been funded privately. This might be the first one. So we're kind of opening up some new territory here.
Do you not envision getting any state dollars?
No,
for such
there will
a
be no. Yeah, that's out of the question. There will be no state dollars for a building like this. There will be no new student fee dollars for a building like this. That's why we have to get this done as much as we can privately.
How much do you think you'll need?
Well, again, it comes down to the building system. We have an architect hired. We're asking them to look at different kinds of building systems that are out there. There's some new techniques. There's some new surfaces that are out there in terms of roofing surfaces and sidewalls and that. So we need to get some more information from them. Originally, if you're going to stick build this thing from scratch and design it from scratch, it's $25 or $30 million, and that's not going to happen. I don't see that happening for us on this particular campus. So are there building systems out there that can bring that price down? I think there are. Using fabric like we have on our roof, that has proven to be can handle the wear and tear over a long period of time. Those buildings are out there. But then you factor in the turf floor. Are you going to put some track surface there to expand your use of Horton and move some of the things there? Netting systems, HVAC, restrooms. Yeah, I don't think it will ever be a competition facility where we bring the public in, because then you've taken a scope. When you bring the public in with seating and restrooms and concourses and all that, that changes the dynamic quite a bit of a building.
So it sounds like it'll kind of serve the current purposes that Horton Fieldhouse does now, just in a modern facility.
Correct. And it'll just because of a turf surface, you open it up for so many other kinds of things too. So we're not quite there yet to say that this is the number. I think we'll have some better ideas here yet this spring.
That was ISU Athletics Director Larry Lyons with GLT's Eric Stock. The new seats at Redbird Arena will be bigger with more leg room, cup holders, handrails, and be closer to the floor. Redbird Arena has also installed new LED lights that Lyons says will pay for themselves over the next decade. After a break, you got to spend money to save money at Illinois prisons. This is Sound Ideas.
Join me as we explore the history and influence of gospel music on rock and soul.
You really can't divorce African-American musical culture from the gospel tradition.
Listen to The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul from NPR.
Hear The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul Sundays during February at 6 p.m. on GLT. It starts out as a flicker, just a glimpse of an idea, maybe a question. But then the GLT newsroom works the phones, checks into it, and it turns out it's more than an idea. It's a good idea. Do people placing Rivian pre-orders match up with the company's marketing targets?
I'm willing to invest in this company, put my trust in them, that they're going to produce the vehicle.
From idea to story to your eyes and ears, this is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A new national report finds that Illinois could save millions of dollars on incarceration costs if the federal government ended the ban on Pell Grants for prisoners. Pell Grants are used to fund college tuition for low-income students. The report from the Vera National Institute of Justice recommends that Congress end the ban on grants for inmates. Margaret DeZeriga is a co-author of the report. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines asked her about the findings and why inmates stopped being eligible for the grants in the first place.
So Pell Grants have been around for decades now. In their earliest inception, people who were incarcerated were eligible. It's really designed for people who meet certain income eligibility requirements such that they cannot afford to pay for tuition. And then in 1994, as part of the crime bill and our tough on crime era, people in state and federal prison lost Pell Grant eligibility. So we saw the number of programs in prison really dwindle.
So I'm curious, what are the benefits for lifting the ban for people who are incarcerated? And is there any evidence to suggest that this population wants to take college courses?
Yeah, there's really high demand for post-secondary educational opportunities in prison. And we also know that there are many benefits to increasing access to post-secondary education in prison. One is that expanding access to education in prison creates safer communities, not only by reducing recidivism, but also reducing violence in prisons. So it improves the safety for incarcerated people and for staff. And our study showed that post-secondary education in prison has the power to increase employment and earnings for formerly incarcerated people, to provide employers with a larger pool of skilled workers from which to hire, and it would save states a combined $365.8 million in reduced prison costs per year. So there's a lot of benefits. I think one important one is also thinking about the benefits to the next generation. So when parents are completing a post-secondary degree while incarcerated, they have the knowledge to pass on to their children around enrolling in college, completing the financial aid paperwork. And we know that when parents increase their educational attainment, their children tend to follow in their footsteps.
Since the restoration of Pell Grants to prisoners could result in more people taking advantage of post-secondary education programs, are colleges and universities ready to serve this population on a greater scale?
You know, if Pell were to be reinstated, there would certainly be a ramp-up period. One of the constraints would be classroom space in prisons, and then there may be some period of time for colleges to get accreditation to work on a, you know, quote-unquote satellite campus, which would be the prison. But I think all of that would be time well spent, because expanding access to post-secondary education by restoring Pell Grants for people in prison, it just makes sense. And this has bipartisan support. States reduce recidivism rates and cut costs. People have greater economic opportunities, and we get more public safety.
If this has bipartisan support and there's research to show it would be financially beneficial, why haven't we reinstated Pell Grants for people who are incarcerated?
From the start of when we really began this trajectory towards creating the system of mass incarceration as a country, we have layered on many impediments to success for, frankly, communities of color primarily. And it's taken time for people to understand what a huge problem we have created and what the ramifications are in our communities. And so I think it similarly has taken time for people to start thinking about how to unravel or how to undo some of those barriers and remove some of those barriers. And we believe that, you know, the time is right for this to be among the next steps. There's support for this. I think there's a lot of interest from employers and thinking about how to have more people with the skills that they're looking for. And so if we can provide access to these opportunities, I think many people will benefit from them.
That was Lee Gaines speaking with Margaret DeZeriga of the Vera Institute of Justice. You can find the interview and more information online at WGLT.org or IllinoisNewsroom.org. This interview was produced in partnership and with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, and the Illinois Newsroom. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of the show. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. And did you know that GLT is making it easier for you to get the latest local news on your Alexa-enabled smart speaker? Add the new GLT skill to your flash briefing to get the latest local newscast. Pair it with NPR's newscast and the Up First podcast, and you've got the perfect start to your day. Learn more about the new GLT flash briefing at wglt.org/smart. Tonight, some rain, likely possible thunderstorms, dropping to a not-so-bad low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow, rain during the day, chance of snow and freezing rain in the late afternoon and early evening. High of 51 degrees early on, but then temperatures plummet for the rest of the day. By Friday, sunny skies and a high of only 18 degrees. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.